Good afternoon, listeners. Glad to have you with me once again for Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. I'm Carolyn. It's September 6th, 2014. I want to start out by thanking Dimitar, my faithful contributor, who sent in another contribution yesterday for the month. And Dimitar is in Ontario, Canada. Thanks, Dimitar. And I don't want to fail to mention that Edgar Steele has died. Most of you already know that, I'm sure, people who listen to this program. But I don't want to ignore it. It's a sad thing. The whole story is a sad story. It was 2 days ago on Thursday in prison. And supposedly, his wife, Cindy, only received a phone call from the mortuary. Nothing from the prison officials, which I would think would have contacted her. Steele's body was already in the mortuary when they notified her. And she, according to something I read, she had not been allowed to visit him, even though she was concerned that his health was deteriorating. She had reason to think so, or she knew it, but they would not allow her to visit. And, there's a lot of strong feeling about Edgar Steele and what happened to him, and I'm not going to go into that. But I'm going to say that how I remember him, and I spoke to him a couple of times on when I called into a radio program that he was appearing on as a guest, because I was very impressed with him. Oh, back in, let's say 2007, 8, 9, maybe 10, I don't know. And he was still very active and appearing on shows, and I think both of them were on RBN. I enjoyed speaking with him. He had a great voice and a great personality. And he had he was never at a loss for having intelligent things to say and answering, and he was very gracious to me, and I'll always remember him that way. I do think that he had some deterioration, and it may have been from his health and his heart problem that he had, but this is not the time to discuss that, and it is the time to remember him and remember Cindy, and think of all the good things he did for the cause of white people in this country. A very, very strong voice and a huge contribution that he made. So I hope that you are, I'm sure that he's in a good place now and that he is at peace. So, speaking of that, well, I had a couple of other things I was going to say in connection, but I think I'll let those go for now. And this brings me to my subject today. I was going to say that Hitler sets the example for us of how men in the movement must really behave. Hitler, I'll just tell this one story. And it's not a reflection on Ed Steele at all, but on a lot of men in our movement and problems that people have, because we're only human, and men have certain weaknesses, you might say, and women have them too, and they can really come back to haunt us if they get the better of us. And I was thinking about Adolf Hitler and his decision not to drink alcohol, and how he came about that, and I think I'll just go ahead and tell that story, because he was just a boy, and he had just graduated from some stage of grammar school. He was probably 15, maybe, or something like that. And he and his fellow students decided to celebrate that night and they bought a big, huge bottle of wine. And a gallon or something like that, and they started drinking it. And Adolf blacked out, obviously, and didn't remember from that point on, but he realized the next day that, you know, he had found his way back to his boarding house very late, and he discovered the next day that he didn't have his the grade report or the graduation report or whatever it was, the little diploma or whatever that was written on paper that had been given to him. It wasn't in his pocket. And his landlady urged him to go and look for it. I guess he did. I don't remember this part real exactly, but anyway, he found it, and he discovered that what had happened to him was that he was so drunk, and he wandered off, and he got sick and defecated on himself, and he was obviously trying to clean himself with this piece of paper that he had, which is his graduation diploma or something equivalent to it. And he was so horribly humiliated by that that he said he vowed then and there he would never drink another drop. He would never drink again, and he didn't. So that was, he was aware of what can happen when you lose control of yourself, when you put yourself at risk like that. And Hitler, being a person who took himself seriously, didn't want those kind of humiliations to come up and haunt him. And you know that in spite of all the abuse that is heaped on him today with lies, there's very little that anybody can seriously find to make his past look bad or make him look bad in any way, because he thought he should be careful not to allow that. And he continued with that all through his life and during the time he was a politician and when he was Führer. And I was thinking about the internet influence in today's world, which I'm going to bring up in a minute. And I was thinking, can you imagine Hitler sitting at a computer and browsing the internet? Well, then I thought, well, maybe we could if it was available then, or if he was around now, and it could be that he would be looking at his party's websites and seeing how they are being presented and his ideas are being presented and making suggestions and so on. So, yeah, I guess I could. But certainly the internet age that we're into today, I think, internationalizes things just by what it is. You know, it opens us up to an international type of thinking. And in the same way, of course, you can say, and it has been said, that plane travel has done, and radio and television has done, and so on. So all these modern technological advances have led us into a smaller world and into seeing the world as one, and seeing and then facilitating ourselves as seeing humanity as one thing. And the idea of what is humanity and how to deal with that whole concept is what today's program is basically about. And it's also about how we, the so-called white race, got to this position, the position of weakness that we all recognize today. We're not in a strong position, and anybody who is realistic about it sees that, and I think we do need to admit it before we can, and recognize it before we can ever expect to change it, to change anything. So doing more of the same never changes anything. So in order to make a difference, we have to recognize what the problem is. And recognizing what the problem is controversial, and of course people have different view of it. So I'm going to be today referring to a classic of post-World War II revisionist literature, which I think helps to point us to the way we got to the weak position that we're in today. I think it's a real excellent introduction to what every white person needs to understand. And this this book I'm referring to is was written in 1948 by a Frenchman, Maurice Bardèche, and the title is Nuremberg or the Promised Land. He followed the Nuremberg Tribunal, which was taking place in Nuremberg, Germany at that time, and as a citizen of France. And he especially paid attention and wrote about the French participation in it, the French delegation, and how they handled it, and what they did, because he was, since he was a nationalist, his part of his argument was that the French people should pay attention to what happened to the French, and they should care, they should be responsible for the story about the French and the Germans, and they didn't need to be to concern themselves with all the others who could be and should be looking out for their interest in this affair on their own. But we'll get into that. I want to point out that George Orwell's 1984, which everybody is very familiar with, was published the following year in 1949, and that theme was basically one of constant war to control the population. Constant war to create constant profits, and we can, what seemed to be the result of that in the book was that it weakened white intelligence further by not allowing any kind of questioning or discussion about what was going on, and of course the constant wars were a total hoax. A total media creation for the consumption of the public, so that they would take a side, and they saw that they thought they had an enemy. They had their side, and this brings to mind what's going on today in Ukraine, and what possibly might be what's going on between the West and Putin's Russia, the European Union and the U.S. versus Putin's Russia. Whether it's a real conflict or whether it's following the same scenario of keeping people taking sides in war situations in order to keep the profits flowing, in order to keep the armament business very going and very profitable. So I'm going to go into that more probably on Monday, because I realize I can't talk about that and this book and the ideas in this book at the same time. But I'm just throwing that out there as something to connect Nuremberg and the past with what's going on today and what is being done to us today from that source. So I hope I'll make a better case of it as I go along than I'm doing right at the moment. I do want to point out that the United States is one of the last places, for all the criticism that we can make of the United States, it's one of the last places on earth where it's legal, though not popular, to speak openly and write about Holocaust revisionism. Think about that. You know, when people decide or think that they want to speak so badly about the U.S. that it should just be destroyed, that they're applauding if the United States goes down into oblivion because it's just Zionist control, Jews, etc., and blah, blah. But yet this is one of the few places where we can speak about Nuremberg and World War II and Holocaust freely, even though it's not exactly, picked up by the media or publishing and so on, but it can be done, and books are published, and yet just this has not actually been the case in Russia as free as we have it here. But now, under Putin just recently, as most of you know, he has joined the European Union. And he hasn't done it to join the European Union, but he does join it in doing so, in passing laws forbidding Holocaust revisionism, and even questioning the Nuremberg verdicts under threat of fine and prison. So very draconian, very much disallowed to question these incidents from 1935 or 1933 or whatever. It's also disallowed to do any speak well of National Socialism and the Third Reich. So that's takes in that whole time period. But mostly it is the war and the National Socialists, which they call the Nazis, and then the findings of the Nuremberg Tribunal. So because of this is why I don't understand how people can still believe that white people should turn to Russia and Putin as an alternative to Europe. You see, I understand the disillusion with Europe. I understand the disillusion with the United States, and I share it. But I don't see the point of turning to Russia, considering these facts that I just stated. As an alternative. So let me say that the forces whose desire it is to extinguish our nationalist and ethnic feelings and loyalties have been the source both in the Nuremberg propaganda and in Jewry. So the enemy of, let's say, if we want to think simplistically in terms of white people, European people, and nationalist and ethnic feelings and loyalty, that the desire to extinguish all this, to destroy it all, and put something else in its place really goes back to Nuremberg, the Nuremberg Tribunal, in which Jewry played a very large part, but not the total. They were not totally responsible for it. And this has been going on so long since then, because as I pointed out, or have I pointed out yet, that was 1948, and now it's 2014, so all this time this has been functioning, and we whites have become misguided and confused about the best course of action, very possibly. And some of this confusion can be seen in a couple of comments I saw just this morning on a pro-white website. There was a comment, and then there was a reply to it, and I'm going to read it. And I received a comment from a listener of mine, which I'm going to bring up later on in the program. Maybe it's possible that it would be more appropriate right here. But anyway, that's the way I set it up, so I do have that coming up. And that was someone who wrote to me because I was recently on the 314. I was recently interviewed by Lana of the Red Eyes Radio, Laktoff. Now I don't have her name in front of me, and I've forgotten it exactly. I think it's Laktoff. Lana of Red Eyes Creations Radio, and that's currently up on their site. I think it went up a couple days ago. And this person wrote to me because he heard that. So this is someone kind of different that is not usually listening to me, which is nice. To reach some new people that way. By the way, Lana is a lovely person. I really enjoyed doing the interview very much. just talking with her. I didn't enjoy all that I said, all the questions I was answering so much. They might not have been what I would have chosen, but But I did enjoy her, and she's really special, a special person. And this person really personified what why white Europeans who want to think in terms of saving their race have so much difficulty in knowing which way to go. But before since I'm not going to do that right now, I'll go ahead with this comment and reply that I saw this morning. And this commenter wrote, "Is a Europe of the fatherlands, in quotes, even a possibility any longer? I think not. Our race cannot afford any more intra-racial conflict, which is what European ethno-nationalisms inevitably foster. Whites must see themselves as race firsters, as whites before they see themselves as German, English, etc." Well, let me just stick in right here that I see it differently. I think we just must see ourselves as Germans, English, etc. first, and then as whites. But anyway, he says, that is both a tactical necessity, the enemies are outside the race, and a stance aligning white nationalism with the future, which is only going to be one of greater intra-European ethnic mixtures, which he puts in parentheses, an inevitable Americanization of Europe. And I think this, well, I don't know, I won't say. The concern is to prevent panmixia. Of course, he presents no idea how to prevent panmixia, which is a word obviously he made up, but means mixing everybody together too much by Americanizing Europe into a intra-European single entity. So I think a pan-European, he goes on, I think a pan-European nationalist focus is quite correct. Specific ethno-nationalisms are fine if seen as stepping stones to a Europe-wide racial nationalism. Well, then someone wrote to him, replied right away and said, that's a pretty asinine position to take. You are an egalitarian who devalues cultural, linguistic, and ethnic differences. You seek to melt all the European ethnic groups down to the lowest common denominator. All you care about is preserving some kind of generic whiteness. It doesn't matter to you if Armenians come out on top in the melting pot or if the Laps do. It's all the same to you. Meaning the white is white, and it doesn't matter which one. And then he continues, ethnic nationalism doesn't have to lead to conflict. Someone who values his nation can still value his race. All the major pro-white political parties in Europe are ethnic nationalists. Trying to abolish all the nations of Europe is what will create conflict. My sympathies are with this person who replied, but this is an argument that is going pretty strongly today, and it's not solved or it's not over, and probably I don't know if it ever will be, but there you have, and this relates to Maurice Bardèche's book. So that's why I brought it up here, that can we afford to have fatherlands, or is there even among white racialists, is it something that doesn't work for us anymore, and we need to have a European Union type of thing, but done the way we like it to be. Well, okay, I'll go on. Now, I read this book. I'd wanted to read this book, Nuremberg or the Promised Land, since I first put a selection from it up at January27.org website. And when after I read through it, I went ahead and posted the whole book on at www.jan27.org. And if you go there, it's on the sidebar on the front page, you can see where it is under Carlo Mantogno's book, So, and that's another way you click on there and go and read the entire book if you want to. And it's a pretty long book, and probably not very many people are going to feel they have the time to read the whole thing. But I took out portions of it that especially struck me, and that's what I'm going to be reading here and commenting on for the rest of this program. And I do invite phone callers. I'll go ahead and give out the number now, although it's probably better to wait until more of the show has been, I've completed more of the show. But the number is 323-642-1206. And you can also send an email to Carolyn@CarolynJaeger.net. If I can remember to go and look at my email account. I do have it up here, but I'm not seeing it. And if I have to click on there and go over there. But because there's a lot of ideas here that somebody might want to make a comment on, but please don't call in to comment on Edgar Steele or anything else, because I don't want to take up this program with that. So let's see, I'm getting to my beginning here. I took out, like I said, I took out what struck me, and I'm sure there's a lot that's really good in there. I know there is, that I didn't take out. I just skipped by it, even because I just couldn't read everything. But I have, I think, a pretty good selection here that gives a good idea of what Maurice Bardet's point is. And he was considered a fascist in France by, I don't know if everybody considered him that, but the left did. And he was a nationalist and obviously had sympathy with the National Socialists in Germany, but his book here is not in any way a polemic or really one-sided. He accepts, you'll get the idea of what the point that he's trying to make is, and he seemed to have a real vision. He had a great grasp of what was really going on in that Nuremberg tribunal, and had a grasp of where it would lead and why they wanted to lead things there and what was actually going on and what the purpose of it was. So this is what I'm going to try to bring out as I read this. And I'm starting not at the beginning of the book, and I'm not even sure where this first section is that I took out. I couldn't find it again. But I don't know where it came, but I thought from the beginning here, or at least from the next section that I have, I went from the beginning to the end of the book. I just went directly through the book and copied portions out of it. So I'll start reading here. This permanent warning, he's talking about the permanent warning what we get from the tribunal. It prepares for us a form of political life of which we should not be unaware, and of which the experience of the last 3 years on the continent does not permit us to be unaware. And the last 3 years would be 1945 to 1948. The condemnation of the National Socialist Party goes much further than it seems to. In reality, it reaches all the solid forms, all the geological forms of political life. I like he uses geological. He says, every nation, every party which urges us to remember our soil, our tradition, our trade, our race is suspect. Whoever claims right of the first occupant, meaning, I think, indigenous people, and calls to witness things as obvious as the ownership of the city, offends against a universal morality which denies the right of the people to write their laws. This applies not just to the Germans. It is all of us who are dispossessed. Not one has any more the right to sit down in his field and say, This ground belongs to me. No one has any more the right to stand up in the city and say, quote, we are the old ones. We built the houses of this city. Anyone who does not want to obey our laws should get out, unquote. It is written now that a council of impalpable beings has the capacity to know what occurs in our houses and our cities. Crimes against humanity. This law is good, this one is not good. Civilization has the right to veto. Here he's referring by civilization as what the Allies, victors, called the civilized world that they represented. And they had the right to say what was a crime against humanity and what wasn't, what was good and what was not good. And these it's not up to the people anymore to say about their own country or their own city or their own land what they think is good or not good. So, next section. I don't know if this follows from before, if there's a separation. I'm not sure here, but he writes, we lived up to now, which is 1948. Let's remember that when this was written, because it makes a difference. We lived up to now in a solid universe whose generations had deposited stratification one after the other. Yeah, this follows because he's referring to the geological forms of political life. He says that each generation deposited their own stratification of the record of who they were. And he says this happened one after the other. All was clear. The father was the father. The law was the law. The foreigner was the foreigner. One had the right to say that the law was hard, but it was the law. Today, these sure bases of political truth are anathema, for these truths constitute the program of a racist party condemned at the Court of Humanity. The Court of Humanity being, of course, the Nuremberg Court. In exchange, the foreigner recommends to us a universe according to his dreams. There are no more borders. There are no more cities. From one end to the other of the continent, the laws are the same, and also the passports, and also the judges, and also the currencies. Only one police force and only one brain. The senator from Milwaukee inspects and decides. I tried to find this morning who the senator from Milwaukee could have been, but nothing fit. So I'm at a loss as to who that is, if anybody knows. But it's not Joseph McCarthy, and it's not and Robert Taft and Dodd are not from Milwaukee, and we're not from Wisconsin, so I don't know. But continuing. These people are the judges, and he writes, in return for this, trade is free. At last, trade is free. We plant some carrots, which by chance never sell well, and we buy some hoeing machines, which always happen to be very expensive, and we are free to protest, free, infinitely free, to write, to vote, to speak in public, provided that we never take measures which can change all that. That is, we don't try to change what we're protesting against and speaking about. We just speak about it, and we can even protest it. We are free to get upset and to fight in a universe of wadding. Wadding, W-A-D-D-I-N-G, meaning cotton wadding. I'm sure you've heard that expression. I think of every bottle of pills, or most of them are filled with a lot of wadding, cotton, I mean, because to keep the pills from shaking around and maybe breaking up because they don't fill up the bottles. But there's other ways, you can put cotton all around to protect, even in a room, to protect people from hurting themselves and so on. So you can fight, we can fight, but it's in the universe of wadding, where it doesn't mean anything. One does not know very well where our freedom ends, where our nationality ends. One does not know very well where what is permitted ends. It is an elastic universe. One does not know anymore where one's feet are set. One does not even know anymore if one has feet. One feels very light, as if one's body has been lost. But for those who grant us this simple ablation, what infinite rewards, what a multitude of tips. The ablation is surgical removal or loss of a part. For those who grant us this, who take this away from us, we have such wonderful rewards in return. This universe, which they polish up and try to make look good to us, is similar to some palace in Atlantis. There are everywhere small glasswares, columns of false marble, inscriptions, magic fruits. By entering this palace, you abdicate your power. In exchange, you have the right to touch the golden apples and to read the inscriptions. You are nothing anymore. You do not feel any more the weight of your body. You have ceased being a man. You are one of the faithful of the religion of humanity. Humanity is always in capital H. At the bottom of the sanctuary, there sits a Negro god. You have all the rights except to speak evil of the god. Well, after this, I took things from his where he's right, telling us about the bills of indictment at the trial. You know, which were those four crimes that were used against the people on trial, the what you call National Socialist hierarchy, and that also included organizations like the National Socialist Party and the SS organization and others. And these were the crime of conspiracy, the crimes against peace, crimes of war, and crimes against humanity, sometimes called war crimes, and crimes against humanity, the fourth one. And I'm not good. I didn't take anything from the first one. I'm starting with the second section of the Bill of Indictment concerns the crimes against peace. As is known, the United Nations accuses the German government of having caused the World War by invading Polish territory, an invasion which forced France and England, in conformity with their commitments, to declare themselves to be in a state of war with Germany. They, moreover, make the German government responsible for the spread of this war because of its aggression with regard to neutral countries. The charge also claims to establish premeditation by means of two confidential documents discovered in German archives, documents whose authenticity there is little point in denying given the precautions which were taken for their identification. One is known under the name of the Hossbach Note, that's spelled H-O-S-S-B-A-C-H, the other under the name of the Schmunt file, Schmunt, S-C-H-M-U-N-D-T. The Hossbach Note is the official minutes written by Hitler's aide-de-camp of a conference at the Chancellery on November 5, 1937, attended by the principal Nazi chiefs. This note is introduced as if it were Hitler's political legacy, which of course it wouldn't have been, but... He goes on, it is an expose, very dramatic moreover, of the theory of Lebensraum and its consequences. Hitler there presents National Socialist Germany as doomed to asphyxiation and condemned to find more land. Doomed to suffocation because they are too crowded and therefore they were forced to find more land. He designates, that is, Hitler designates the East as the necessary route for the colonial expansion of the Reich, and he shows that this expansion can be made only by a series of wars of conquest to which Germany is inexorably forced. We will have more to say later about this exposé. If it should be interpreted as the indictment interpreted it, the defendants, however, and in particular Göring, disputed this interpretation. But if it were interpreted as the indictment interpreted it, it would constitute proof that Hitler saw and accepted the possibility of war. Now, the Schmunt file is the official minutes, also written by Hitler's aide-de-camp, who at this date was Colonel Schmunt, of a conference of the Chancellery on May 23, 1939, at which were present the party chiefs and the heads of Hitler's staff. Now, let me just mention here that Colonel Schmunt was present on July 20th, 1944, in the map room during that meeting when the bomb went off that was placed by Colonel Stauffenberg to assassinate Hitler. And Hitler survived rather miraculously, as so many other times he did. But Schmunt was killed. He didn't die right away. He had very bad injuries, and I think they tried to save him for 2 months. It took 2 months later, but he finally succumbed to his wounds, which were too great. So he was one of several who were killed during this event, and others were injured, of course, including Hitler, but only fairly lightly. So this conference that of May 23rd, 1939, though, that we're speaking of here, consisted primarily of a talk by Hitler in which he affirms the inevitability of a war with Poland as the first step in the action of colonial expansion. Hitler considers the consequences of this war and envisages its spreading to the whole of Europe, and by an analysis as dramatic as the preceding one, he makes his generals understand the coming war would not be a local operation, but will probably be the beginning of a fight to the death with England, of which no one can envisage the outcome. Then Bardesh writes in a note about this. He says, some are less sanguine about the authenticity of the Hossbach note. That was the first one I read you. Carlos Whitlock Porter, in documents used in evidence at the Nuremberg trial, which you can find at his website under document HTM, comments about it thus. Document 386 PS, the Hossbach protocol, Hitler's supposed speech of 5 November 1937, is a certified photocopy of a microfilm copy of a retyped certified true copy prepared by an American of a retyped certified true copy prepared by a German of unauthenticated handwritten notes by Hossbach of a speech by Hitler written from memory 5 days later. And Porter says, this is not the worst document, but one of the best, because we know who made one of the copies. So, Porter never lets anything go by without pointing out its deficiencies, much more than Bardesh is doing here, but he does tell us about what Porter said here. The note itself says that Hitler on this occasion asked, in the interest of a long-term German policy, that this exposition be regarded, in the event of his death, as his last will and testament. Here, too, supposedly Hitler put a lot of stock in this, and he wanted it, if something happened to him, he wanted it to go down as his wish that this expansion into the East be done, that it was necessary for the Reich to do this, I could accept that, but I don't know about about the truth of that. Here, too, there are reservations and considerations which spring to mind, Bardesh writes, and the defense also disputes the scope and thrust of the Schmunt document. With this reservation, the Schmunt file has the same purport as the Hasbach note, of which it represents basically just an application. It would prove in the same way that Hitler was not unaware of the consequences of his policy and accepted the possibility of a European war while still entertaining the hope that he could avoid one. If these documents were correctly interpreted, that is, if what he means here is that if the documents were correctly interpreted by the court, it is difficult to maintain that Germany does not carry any share of responsibility for the war. But the documents had been questioned. The interpretation had been disputed by Göring, for one, and some of the other men on trial. But in any case, he's even saying, though, that even if it was interpreted the way the court says, it would be that Germany carried a share of the responsibility, but not all of the responsibility. They didn't prove that. So, going on, I'm skipping ahead. I don't know how much, but skipping ahead to a new section. Thus, in this area where the facts appeared to overwhelm the German government, one realizes that the reality was not so simple. To present the facts without context is a manner of lying. There are no bare facts. There are no documents without circumstances. To systematically ignore these circumstances is to disguise the truth. Our lies will not be eternal. Tomorrow, the German nation will raise its voice in its turn, and we know already that the world will be constrained to take account of this voice. It will say to us that if Hitler attacked Poland, other men anxiously awaited this attack, desired this attack, prayed that it take place. These men were called Mandel, or I think it'd just be Mandel, M-A-N-D-E-L, or Mandel, Churchill, Horribilisha, Paul Reynaud. Now Mandel, see note 17 above, I don't have that here, but I'm not sure who he was, but Horribilisha was a British Jew whom Neville Chamberlain appointed Secretary of State for War in 1937. He introduced conscription in Britain in 1939. He was considered a war hawk. And Paul Reynaud was French Prime Minister at the time of the beginning of World War II. He had long opposed appeasement and German expansion. So he was another war hawk in France who was prime minister at the time. And they, according to Bardesh here, even if Hitler did attack Poland, these men, these leaders in, including Churchill, in England and France, that's exactly what they wanted. It was exactly what they were hoping for, that Hitler should attack Poland, because that was their opportunity to start the war, so, and to declare war on Germany. So that's very true and pretty well established. The Judeo-Reactionary Alliance wanted its war, which was for it a holy war. It knew that only a blatant aggression would enable it to manipulate public opinion. The German archivists will have hardly any trouble proving to us that the Allied leaders have coldly manipulated the public about the conditions of this aggression. Fear the day when the history of this war will be written. Well, he's talking about how the French, if they're not truthful, I don't know if he's going to talk about the French. He may be talking about all of them now. That the day will come when their lies and their wrongdoing is going to come up to haunt them. Of course, that day hasn't come yet. But he says, fear the day when the history of this war will be written, because he doesn't know in 1948 the way they are going to be able to keep this whole war and everything about it from being questioned. He does understand it's going to be happening, but I think he thinks that the truth about these things always comes out, and it won't take that long. That, you know, in our lifetimes or whatever, in some period of time, this will happen. But as I said, it hasn't happened yet. So that's because they've got a stranglehold on the whole thing. But he says that at that moment, the context of the local aggressions will appear clearly. The silence of the Allies will then become a self-indictment. It will be seen that they omitted to say that their ploys and their intrigues made the intervention inevitable. Their hypocrisy will appear in full light, and their enormously legal machine will be turned against them because its dishonesty will have been recognized. For he who pours the poison is no less guilty than he who strikes. However, the methods of Nuremberg are a beautiful thing. The absence of any Allied documents makes it possible to deny the poison, and international law makes it possible to designate as guilty him who is the first to strike. It is the combination of two dishonesties, one bearing on the investigation, the other stemming from the code. With a badly made law and dishonest police officers, we know that one can go far. The truth has been demonstrated to us at our expense. Thus, we have been brought to this first conclusion, that the Nuremberg trial is not a pure crystal. The National Socialist plot led to a strong Germany, but this strong Germany did not necessarily lead to war. It asked for the right of life. It asked for it by methods which were irritating, but one could talk with them. Germany was in a permanent state of rebellion against international constraints, and it was not in a permanent state of crime against peace. Okay? He's saying that Germany was in a permanent state against the international, rebelling against the international constraints that had been put upon it since the end of the First War, but it was not in a state of crime against peace. It was not trying to destroy peace in the world. The outbreak of war was due to a combination of circumstances much more complex than the official version admits. Everyone did his share, and everyone had had excellent reasons to do so. The USSR to think only about it and to want to avoid a trap. England and France to put a definite stop to German expansion. Germany to want to break its opponent's smothering policies. So he said everybody had reasons to go to war. The USSR to avoid what it thought would be a trap from the West. He wanted them to go to war. And England and France to stop German, what they called, thought of as German expansion, which was largely economic expansion. And then Germany to break the policies that were smothering it of these other countries. And everyone also had ulterior motives and reservations. Would it not be wiser to make a general confession of it? No one is innocent in this affair, and there are things which they definitely do not want to explain. It is much more convenient to have a criminal. Well, you know, if at that time, or some shortly after, not too long a time after, they decided to make a general confession of fault amongst all the parties involved, that would have been acceptable. But now, after all this time, I don't think it's acceptable at all. That would not be sufficient at all to just say, we agree that we were wrong too, so let's just put all this aside now and not talk about it anymore. No. So going on to a further forward in the book, he writes, this much was obvious, and they knew it. The old diplomacy would probably have tolerated the divisions of Poland. It was not the first time, and the World War would have been avoided. The annexation of Ethiopia, the disappearance of Czechoslovakia, were they not operations infinitely less expensive for humanity than the outbreak of a world war? That was not right. It was not right to avoid war in those cases, world war. But the amputation of a quarter of Germany for the benefit of Slavic imperialism, the appalling transfer of millions of human beings whom one has treated for 4 years like cattle, are these things right? Statesmen formerly knew that one should risk a general war only for infinitely serious causes, which put in danger the existence of all nations. And they also knew that it is necessary to make some concessions to the inevitable laws of life. Were we exposed to a mortal danger by the division of Poland? Of course, his answer is no, we weren't, but he says, is not the danger that the democratic statesmen manufactured with their own hands infinitely more grave? And is not our situation infinitely more dramatic? Who today does not think that Europe was beautiful in August 1939? Meaning, what was done because of a division of Poland has made Europe an awful place, has destroyed much of Europe, and he's comparing it to August 1939, when and how much better it was then. Then in September 1st, of course, Germany went into Poland, but his idea is that that could have been tolerated too. And he goes on to say, political forces are natural forces like water and wind. They should be channeled by precise and powerful devices, or is it necessary to navigate by sail? If after wars we do not want to impose servitude, which is one of the forms of natural law, it is necessary to accept the alternative, to make viable treaties, and to let vigorous peoples develop. The disadvantages which result from their growth are finally much less serious than the start of a general war, of which the result benefits only those who threaten our civilization. Well, to me, he's saying there that people who are a vigorous people, and they have it, you know, they have a, feel compelled to develop and grow, that whatever disadvantages you might see from the growth of these people, it's less serious than starting a general war, which can only benefit those who want to destroy or our civilization or who are threats to our civilization. So what he's saying in that part is that it was an overreaction that these countries didn't need to go to war in this way over this, over Poland even, and that and even over Germany's desire to grow and expand, that would have been better for the world if they really cared about the world and if they really cared about Europe. That would have been better than what happened with this war. Makes a lot of sense today in retrospect for sure. So now he's talking about the third bill of indictment, war crimes, and says the third section of the bill of indictment is, like the second, of a very traditional type. It concerns war crimes. The court here relies on a precise text, the Hague Convention of 1907. It calls war crimes acts made by belligerents in violation of these conventions, which regulate the methods which sovereign states have recognized as being in conformity with the laws of war. There's nothing to object to in this process. We will see further on where the dishonesty about this begins, but it was discovered very quickly that the promulgated international law, that is the text of the Hague Convention, would not make it possible to reach acts which they wanted to make the Germans pay for. So they invented a new category, as we said, that of crime against humanity. And this term was used as the title for the fourth section of the Bill of Indictment. But as no one knew very well where war crimes finished and where crimes against humanity started, and since in addition it was advantageous to slip into an uncontestable category, acts which actually belonged in the contested category, the third and fourth section were constantly confused. I guess the crimes of war was a kind of an uncontestable category, whereas the, no, maybe it's the other way around. The crimes against humanity was, one of them was considered uncontestable and the other contestable. And I guess we have to figure that out ourselves. He doesn't say. And it is figures we know. But at that time, it might have been more clear. And it is impossible for us to separate them in our analysis, although the public ministry based these two charges on very different principles. And then there's a space. I'm going to real quick go take a look at my email since I mentioned it. He writes, there is an abundant literature on the German atrocities, but this literature is in opposition with what we have all seen. 40 million French men and women saw the Germans for 3 years in their cities, on their farms, in their houses, on their roads, and they did not find them to be such monsters. Is it we who have been victims of an enormous camouflage under which the beast was hidden and disguised? And the reports which we were given, were they not exaggerated? We derive no benefit from defending good Germany, for the policy of the French government during the occupation appears much more effective if the Germans are indeed monsters. The resistance, on the contrary, may find it beneficial to display their sufferings. One knows well enough that sufferings are easily transformed into plazas. I think that's funny, but he's again being, I guess you'd say, a little ironic there. Obviously, plazas in France were being renamed after the war for victims of the war. And he finally says, were we mistaken about the Germans? We were ready to recognize this in good faith. We would not be diminished by it. But is it true? He's saying that this idea that the Germans were, according to the reports of France, this French delegation at the trial was exaggerating, you know, what had happened in France, and they took reports from people who had a really terrible story to tell, and he mentions here the resistance. Resistance, which would be members of the resistance, I think, who were resisting the National Socialist occupation, and they have their stories and what was done to them and so on, but he's saying that ordinary Frenchmen didn't see any evidence of this amongst Germans all those years they were there. And then he says, well, were we mistaken about the Germans? He said, we're ready to recognize that they were really monsters, and it would not hurt us in France because France just benefits from it. But he says, is it true? Now we go ahead a little bit more in the book, and he writes, what occurred in Auschwitz, in Majdanek, and other places concerns the Slavs. We, meaning the French, we have no concern ourselves with the Occident. We have to concern ourselves with the Occident. Let us not claim those debts which the debtor does not pursue, but let us take care to rectify here the excesses of our own propaganda. What is important for us is to know what the Germans have done to us. It is on this point that we will question the documents of Nuremberg. This is one of the themes of his book, of what he wrote, is that the French should stick to what happened to the French in their complaints at Nuremberg. Instead, they went on and took, you know, went on and complained about what was done in the East to the Slavs and to the Jews and to everybody. They took up for those people in their complaints, in their actual condemnations, since they are one of the legal parties there, you know, to bring the prosecution. They had they were had their own prosecution. The French did, as each country did, each of the four. And they and Bardèche is saying that as French, as the French, and as the French delegation, we should only be bringing up what happened to the French, and not to anybody else. They can they are responsible for doing that for themselves, and they can do it, you know. So he goes on then. Our goal is thus to ask ourselves first. The German atrocities, about which one reads recollections every day in our press, have they been proven? And the most solemn of our complaints, the only authentic one, that which was expounded at Nuremberg, what proofs support it? Instead of going on immediately to the examination of principles, and instead of sitting down near the judge and watching him judge, it is necessary for first, excuse me, it is necessary first here to look into the evidence cited. It is necessary to try to see what is solid in the indictment. We are going with the court to listen to the witnesses and to smell the exhibits. So here he's saying that that people want to right away just join up with the judge. He puts it instead of sitting down near the judge and watching him judge. I thought that was funny too. He's, you know, I mean, instead of just listening to the judges and what they came up with in the end, we need to look at the evidence. But most people were not doing that. And see what was solid and see what isn't. Of course, as we say, most people are not doing that at all. But he's pointing that out. And so now he's looking at the evidence. And he says, it is in reports that the French delegation shines the most. One feels, he's a little bit cynical there, one feels a certain embarrassment here to say all that one thinks. For he who wonders about the exactitude of the facts and the probity of the witnesses, while one tells him the report of others, while these witnesses tell him the report of others' suffering, exposes himself to the reproach that he lacks heart and even that he is inaccessible to the simplest human feeling. That's a long sentence. He's actually pointing out that you have to wonder about the facts and the witnesses, whether they're telling the truth or not. But if you do that, if you question that, You are then exposed to the reproach that you lack heart and even that you are lacking the simplest human feeling. See, that's that emotional element that comes in. You can't question these people. And he says, but it is impossible not to say what reports told by non-eyewitnesses who heard them from non-eyewitnesses, reports, moreover, which have been spread around and are necessarily presented without their accompanying circumstances, all in all constitute only a means of arousing emotion. But in no case do they replace a serious and complete investigation of the behavior of the German army in France. These are only isolated instances. They're still talking about what the Germans did in France to French people. And he's using that same argument that that these are, well, he's now using the argument that these are isolated instances. And he says, and as such, it is possible that they implicate the responsibility of local officers, but one cannot claim to present the history of the military occupation of France between 1940 and 1944 by means of 12 reports of tortures or reprisals, all of which take place in 1944, and in areas where there was a sniper at the corner of each small wood. About such matters, it is necessary to say nothing, or it is necessary to say everything. A partial account is a biased account. About this, one day they will tell us, France lied. Well, a lot of us are telling them that. A lot of good people are telling them that. But unfortunately, Germany as a nation is not telling them that. And he imagined at this time that Germany would get back on its feet, so to speak, and would be investigating all of this and complaining and putting forth its objections to this trial, and it would have a whole lot to use legally and so on. And he's just speaking about France now. He says, what was France going to do when all its bad behavior was brought out? But you see, they set that up. They made sure that Germany wouldn't and couldn't do that. And Germany has never come back to normal. Has never risen again. And that's why. That's the big reason. The main reason why all of this still stands, because there's no Germany to object to it. So going on. He now says, yes, in the east of Europe, there is a terrible score to be settled between Germany and its neighbors. Yes, there was a policy of extermination. And there, one found traces of it. Not by an enumeration, our favorite method. Not by samples. One found the plans for it in the Führer's conferences. One found the instructions for the persons in charge. One found orders. One found everything. This alarming policy seems to have been carried out, unfortunately. At least there are documents which say so. And if we share at all the hypocritical pain of indictors of Germany, it is by our sincere pain while thinking of these men and these women of Ukraine who received the Germans with flowers as though their coming meant salvation and the right to live, and who were massacred, famished, exterminated, stupidly, by these men whom they received with cheers and who had perhaps in their pockets the order to make them disappear. That, yes, that is a crime. But is it true? He asked. There are all sorts of things in these documents, and they were not always classified with prudence. One presented several times the orders, discussions, which were only memoranda. One presented several times as orders, discussions which were only memoranda, that is, suggestions which were rightly rejected. Other times one showed orders, but it turned out in the course of the trial itself that these orders were not carried out by the army commanders, who found them too severe. Other times one was mistaken about the meaning of certain measures. For example, the systematic destruction of villages was not a policy of terrorism, but a means of fighting partisans, which consisted in evacuating the cattle, then the inhabitants, and finally in destroying the dwellings themselves, so as to create around the partisans a kind of burned earth similar to that which the Russian command itself had created around German divisions. In the same way, destruction of buildings or harvests, raids on the populace, were employed by the two armies, the Russian army in its retreat and the German army in its retreat. The Germans have even asserted that they had done an immense amount of construction in Ukraine, that they often had helped and supplied the population, which is the exact opposite of what one tells them. Whom then ought one to believe? The figures presented by the Russian delegation are unverifiable. Get that. You can't verify what the Russian delegation is saying. What if the Russian delegation had used the Nuremberg trial for an enormous display of propaganda like the French delegation. We can check on what the French delegation says that occurred in our own lands, but who can check on what the Soviet delegation says? On this point, the trial is open, and we would be very wrong to believe it's settled by the verdict. Okay. So then moving forward in the book some more, he writes, as for the concentration camps, honesty consists in our demanding justice and reparations for the innocent French who were deported and tortured, but not for the others. It appears impossible for us to accept in this field the confusion about which we spoke above and which was created intentionally by propaganda. It appears impossible for us not to make in particular the distinction which the Germans made between the Jews and the non-Jews. If one refuses this discrimination, one sees only Jews, many Jews, and obviously many deaths. But also one can conclude nothing. What did the Germans do to you, just to you, in France? They took away the Jews. To you in Belgium, they took away the Jews. To you in Holland, they took away the Jews. By maintaining this confusion, all that one has the right to say is that the Germans pursued in Holland, in Belgium, and in France a policy of extermination of the Jews. But then this accusation is no more an accusation, by the French people or by the Belgian people or by the Dutch people against Germany. It is an accusation which should be brought by the Jewish people and be supported by Jewish delegates or by delegates speaking in the name of the Jewish people and not by any national delegation. See, because the French delegation was the French delegation. It represents the French nation, the French people. And so that's why he's saying that. And he's saying, however, the various national delegations, and especially the French delegation, carefully maintained this confusion. Well, it's interesting there that he is actually saying, and he goes into it a little bit more to, you know, put some basis to it, that he's distinguishing between the Jews and the non-Jews, between the Jews and the French. And he's also saying that that it's not up to Europe to defend the Jews. The Jews should be defending themselves if they can, but as usual, the Jews have got everybody else defending them as though that's just the most normal and natural thing in the world, that Jews had to be defended by everybody else wherever they're living, and that's accepted too. This is a kind of a different idea here, that he's putting himself somewhat at odds with the general thinking. So moving forward in the book, I then have this section, a long section. He says, the whole question is to know if we can admit the German distinction in this debate. However, here's what a Frenchman cannot avoid asking himself. The Jews are originally foreigners who were initially allowed into our country warily, then in an increasingly large number, as some of them obtained influence. In spite of this hospitality, which was granted to them, they did not abstain from taking part in the political discussions of our country. And when it was a question of knowing if we would transform the invasion of Czechoslovakia or the war in Poland into a European war, they did not hesitate, and it is they who currently affirm this to us, to fight any spirit of conciliation, that is, to involve our country in a disastrous but desirable war because it was directed against an enemy of their race. We have ceased today being a great nation, speaking of France. We have perhaps even ceased actually being an independent nation because their wealth and their influence have made their point of view prevail over that of the French, who are attached to the conservation of their land and who wanted to maintain peace. We found them then opposed to all reasonable measures which could have preserved our lives and our goods, and at the same time their own lives and their own goods. And later still we found them at the head of the persecution and calumny against those of our comrades who had wanted to protect from the rigors of the occupation this country where we have lived longer than they, where our parents have lived, and which the men of our race had made a great country. They say today that they are the true husbands of this land, which their parents did not know, and that they understand better than we the wisdom and the mission of this country, of which some of them can hardly speak the language. They divided us. They claimed the blood of the best and the purest among us, and they rejoiced, and they are rejoicing at our deaths. This war that they wanted, they gave us the right to say that it was their war and not ours. They paid for it the price which one pays for all wars. We have the right not to count their deaths with our death. You know what he's saying here about in France? It's so true in the United States. And we know this. We hear it all the time from Jews, that they understand better the mission of our country. They formed all these things, you know. I'm thinking of the Anti-Defamation League, that is one, but I mean the one that seeks equal justice for everyone. All I can think of is ADL, sorry about that. ACLU, you know, they form things like that, and they're behind them, and they dictate what the United States is all about. And they say all the time, well, the United States, the meaning of the United States is this, you know, it's a land for immigrants and blah, blah. They have taken over the job of the right to define what the United States of America and what America is. So that's, I just really liked that part especially much. Then he writes, in spite of the silence imposed on our intellectuals, this effort to pose the Jewish question in concrete terms cannot be eluded. It need not at all be accompanied by anti-Semitism. And for my part, I am not anti-Semitic. I wish, on the contrary, that the Jewish people find somewhere the fatherland that will enable them to group themselves together. But it seems obvious to me that if I were a refugee in Argentina, I would not concern myself with the internal affairs of Argentina, even if I had obtained the nationality of that country. I would not demand that the Argentinians become the avengers of the persecuted French. I especially would not ask that Argentinians be condemned to death or be imprisoned because they were indifferent to the fate of the French refugees in their land. Why should we feel obliged to avenge and lament in the name of a compatriotism that the law forces us to confess but which does not touch our hearts? Fraternities are not manufactured. So I like that very much too. That part is really good. And we have to remember he's writing this in 1948, and he understood how they come into a land, and the Jews do, and then they insist that that all their demands be met, that they be listened to, and that they can begin discussing the internal affairs of their new country, and they can have a voice, and they should have a voice, and if they don't have a voice, they complain very loudly. All of that is just ridiculous, you know. It's ridiculous that they've managed to get away with all of this in convincing people that they do have that right. So continuing on, further ahead in the book, by setting ourselves up as defenders of the Jewish people, by putting ourselves at the head of a crusade of hatred because of the concentration camps, because of all the concentration camps, by extending this hatred to all, by making it inexpiable and without appeal, are we not victims of a propaganda of which the effects might one day be terribly prejudicial to the French people? Again, he's expecting that, you know, the truth to come out, and they're going to look very bad. What will we reply if one seeks one day to make us carry the weight of this revenge for which we have been volunteers? If one tells us that our complaint, our indictment, should have had as its object only the restricted number of Frenchmen who were deported contrary to the laws of war? If one holds us responsible for this storm of hatred and suffering which we have called down on the German nation, which had believed it was treating us gently? That's good. Will we reply by speaking about the great voice of France? I assume the French prosecutor was using that and just saying they were there to express for the French people the great voice of France in this, against this horrible crimes of the Germans. So he says, then let it, will we reply by speaking about the great voice of France? Then let it not keep silent when other injustices and other deaths summon it. If we are, by heaven's decree, the defenders of everyone, the defenders of the Jews and the Slavs, then we do not have the right to exclude anyone, and we must also be the defenders of the Japanese and the Germans when the corpses are Japanese or German. Skipping ahead, the French delegation, the embodiment of logic and firmness, was sorry to hear this word retroactive. It wanted to show that one must not have all these scruples, and that Mr. Goring was juridically only a highwayman, meaning that under their law that they had there, he was nothing more than a robber. He didn't have all these, he didn't have any status that he had had before. And here is the firm step which it took to prove it. It is interesting for us since it lays down a principle broader than the previous one. The Germans, having been the aggressors, the war which they make is illegal, and they put themselves thereby outside of international law. He is saying this is the way that the court managed to do it. And then in quotes, the question, what does that mean? If not that all crimes which will be committed following this aggression for the pursuit of the fight thus started will cease having the judicial character of acts of war. That was taken from the court transcripts, or maybe from the way they set out how to do the the trial. From then on, all becomes very simple. Another quote, acts committed for the pursuit of a war are attacks on people and on goods which are prohibited and sanctioned in all legislations, meaning they are both prohibited and they are sanctioned. It's a confusion there. He says the state of war could make them licit only if the war itself were licit. But subsequent to the Briand-Kellogg Pact, there are no more such wars. Hence, because it outlawed illegal wars, hence these acts become purely and simply crimes against common law. Now, the Briand-Kellogg Pact was officially called the General Treaty for Renunciation of War as an Instrument of National Policy. It was in 1928, an international agreement in which the signatory states promised not to use war. They promised, you see, it was only a promise. They promised not to use war to resolve dispute or conflicts of whatever nature or of whatever origin they may be, which may arise among them. So that didn't last very long, but that's what it was, and then they use it when they want to use it. So there it is. It is no more difficult than that, and it was easy. It was enough just to think so. Just to think that as he's putting it, they thought, we, here's how they think, we, all that we do is listen. Those are acts of war, which are covered by a special rule of the international law, which removes from so-called acts of war any penal qualifications. But they, all that they do, meaning in this case the Germans, for the pursuit of the fight thus started, a very vast expression, is illicit and thereby becomes even a crime against common law. On the one side, order, gravity, conscience, the armies of the right, that is the right-thinking people, bombard Dresden with a feeling of infinite sorrow. And when our Senegalese, the Negroes, rape the girls of Stuttgart, it is an act of war which eludes any penal qualification. On the other side, the common law in uniform and helmet, a troop of brigands wearing various disguises move into a cave called Kommandantur. Now, saying they're wearing uniform. On the one side, these people are wearing uniforms and helmets. And on the other, these others call themselves something, and what they do is called plundering, sequestration, assassination. It is not I who say this. It is, again, the French delegation. As long as they put a uniform on their pilots bombing Dresden, and as long as they, of course, those weren't the French, but as long as they put uniforms on these Senegalese, then it falls under acts of war, and they have there's no penalty for that. But if they can turn it into something illegal, then illicit, then they can penalize it under common law. It's a common crime. And he says that this is what the French delegation was saying: the putting to death of the prisoners of war, of the hostages, and of the inhabitants of the occupied territories falls in French law under the scope of articles of common law. So if Germans did these things, they were criminal. It follows under the scope of articles of common law and following of the penal code, which delineate murder and assassination. I'm not sure if that belongs there. The mistreatments to which the bill of indictment refers fall into the category of wounds and voluntary blows, which are defined by Articles 309 and following the deportation and following, period. The deportation is analyzed independently of the murders by which it was accompanied as an arbitrary sequestration, as described in Articles 341. And then, move up here. And then in the plundering, it was 341 and 344, and then the plundering of public and private property and the imposition of collective fines are sanctioned by Articles 221 and following of our Code of Military Justice. Article 434 of the Penal Code punishes voluntary destruction, and the deportation of civilian workers is assimilated to forced enrollment as envisioned by Article 92. And there it is. That's how the naughty word retroactivity was erased from our papers. It doesn't quite explain that to me, but anyway, that's what he's trying to show here, that that the fact that things were legal, you cannot say that they don't allow retroactivity, so that once they made their new laws, they were followed, and everybody was guilty accordingly, even though that law wasn't in place at the time that this was going on. As he says, that's how the naughty word retroactivity was erased from our papers. All that thanks to this good little Briand Kellogg pack, a dusty crossbow taken down off its hook in the attic, however old it has served to shoot off these beautiful fireworks. The ignoble and monstrous character of this judicial swindle deserves to be underlined. For what purpose it should be known? For that purpose, it should be known that the acts thus defined by our delegation are in addition expressly recognized as rights by the Hague Conventions. What the Germans did were right under the Hague Convention. Armies in war have the right to take hostages, and we have set no restrictions on their doing this. They have jurisdiction over prisoners of war under certain formal conditions. They have the right to ensure order in areas behind the lines and to make arrests. They have the right to condemn and execute agents of the enemy in occupied territory, and in particular, snipers. They have the right to note normal expenses of occupation and to proceed to requisitions while following certain rules, that is, requisitioning the occupied people, such as the right of war, the right of nations, written and agreed upon. And it is this right of war, this right of nations, that our delegation denies to our enemies. International law exists, but it does not exist for them. We, the army of the right, now he's using right differently, the ones who do right, we have a share in all that, not they. We share in all that, not they. And this is all the more beautiful. He's using beautiful sarcastically or ironically by saying how beautifully they worked this out to make it work for them and against the Germans. They said, this is all the more beautiful since while the Germans were here, while they were the strongest, we made demands from them for ourselves on the basis of international law. And when they were the strongest, they were soldiers. They were obliged to apply the law of nations, and we accepted in many circumstances to profit from it. Now that they are the vanquished, they are no longer soldiers. They no longer have the right to claim the law of nations in their turn. They have become common law criminals. It is difficult to be more ignoble and low, he says. But since our resistance, the French resistance, are conscienceless, they are still astonished when we tell them that the French policy since 1944 is for us only a mark of baseness, a subject of shame, and an image of dishonor. Excuse me. I think it's especially important where he says a fighting army has the right to condemn and execute agents of the enemy in occupied territory, and in particular snipers. And this brings us, you know, to the Einsatzgruppen, who had this job to do this and are blamed as called murderers today for doing that in the territory that they were occupying, not just that what was going on in France with the French resistance, but mainly, I'm talking about in the East, where supposedly so many were executed. But they had every right to do that, but they had no opportunity to defend themselves along those lines because they had been labeled illegal. And they weren't a legal army. They were an illegal criminal operation going on. So that's how at Nuremberg they got around all that. And that's how they're still holding Germany responsible for all this murder, they call it, instead of deaths during wartime that were legally carried out. So, so moving ahead in the book further, he writes, it was necessary to be able to maintain that in the most strongly disciplined country which exists and which was under the most absolute regime, and although this regime was for 10 years the legal regime, recognized by the whole world. Nevertheless, the laws, the ordinances, the payments, the orders emanating from this government had no value and protected the executants not at all. Then we refused to recognize anything for what it is. We trampled under our feet the most obvious and elementary evidence. What we have come to maintain surpasses imagination. Now, you know, saying here that the National Socialist regime of Adolf Hitler was recognized worldwide for 10 years as the legal regime in Germany, and yet after the war it was considered not to be so. It was considered illegal, and therefore nothing that took place in there, nothing that they did, was recognized, you know, as having any value, of having any rights to be done. And he says it surpasses imagination to do this. We have forgotten. This is an important part, too. We have forgotten, we have refused to see that the Fuhrer Prinzip, the basis for the German legal regime, made of each private individual a soldier, of each executant a man who did not have the right to discuss the orders, whatever his rank. What ought someone to have done who had the misfortune of being a German general? You see, he's saying that German generals could not resign. If they disagreed with the policy, they couldn't say, well, I resign my office and walk away. They didn't have the right to do that under the Fuhrer principle understood to be the legal political system, if you will, policy system of the Third Reich Germany. They were absolutely forbidden to resign during the war. What then? Our justice allows them to choose between the stake for refusal to obey, that is, execution, and the gallows of Nuremberg for having fulfilled the orders. They ought to have protested. Well, he says, why didn't they protest? But they did protest. The files of the Allies in Nuremberg consisted essentially of reports and protests which the executants of the highest ranks addressed to the district general of the Fuhrer to describe the excesses to which the conduct of the war gave occasion and to demand that one reconsider the too severe orders which had been transmitted to them. So they officially made reports, some of them, protesting what they were asked and ordered to do, and that it was too severe, and they didn't want to have to do it. And he says they were regularly told in response that the Fuhrer or his delegate, Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler, maintained these instructions and that they took full responsibility for them. And this was really believed. He says more about this, but, you know, in their minds and for all Germans, they were told that they had no responsibility as long as they were following orders, that all the responsibility fell on Adolf Hitler. Of course, the world doesn't like that. They don't want it because then Adolf Hitler committed suicide, so they didn't have anybody to punish. So, but think about how this thing all worked out. Considering the way the Reich was set up, he goes on to say a little further on, there was a responsible person in Germany, and there was only one. That was Adolf Hitler. One did not discuss an order of Adolf Hitler. All the greatest said it, and Goering himself said, we were not always in agreement, even on essential points, but once the order was given, the duty was to obey. This absolute discipline, inscribed in the Oath of Fidelity, was presented to the Germans as the basis of their regime and also as a guarantee with regard to their conscience. We know this extremely well, and our judges know it well, says Bardesh. But then here's what they invented. See, they all knew this, but then they invented something to get around it. Contrary to the legislation of the German state, and contrary also to all national legislations, they did not fear to declare, first of all, that no one could regard himself as covered by higher orders. This was done by the Nuremberg Tribunal people, lawyers, before it started. They made this declaration that nobody could say he was only following orders, when they had been doing that all along. But anyway, that was their status. That was their statute, I mean, written in August 1945. In August 1945, they wrote this. After the war, several months after the war, as they were planning their trials, what to do, they passed this, that no one could regard himself as covered by higher orders, which firmly established this new principle, which was, the statute establishes that he who has committed criminal acts cannot find excuses in higher orders. Sir Hartley Shawcross, the British prosecutor, drew the following consequence from this declaration. Shawcross said, political honesty, military obedience are excellent things, but they do not require or justify the commission of notoriously bad acts. There comes a moment when a man must refuse to obey his chief if he wants to obey his conscience, even if the simple private serving in the ranks is not obliged to obey illegal acts. Even the simple private serving in the ranks is not obliged to obey illegal acts. This assertion, if serious, since it makes compulsory conscientious objection, you're forced to be an objector based on your conscience, is not, however, enough for the court, which found a means to come back to this point in the judgment itself. And a quote from the court, he who has violated the laws of war, concludes the court, cannot, in order to justify himself, plead the mandate which he received from the state, once the state, by giving this mandate, has exceeded the powers which international law recognizes in it. Now this really carries a lot of weight and is really very tricky, dishonest kind of a thing. It's saying if the state demands that you do certain things, then the state no longer has any authority, because it's not following international law. Therefore, you don't have to follow what your state tells you to do. Now, goes on, a fundamental idea of the statute is that the international obligations which are imposed on individuals have precedence over their duty of obedience toward the state of which they are citizens. The international obligations imposed on individuals take precedence over the obligation of obedience to your own state. Now this, I just have a remark here that this is the Jewish basis of the destruction of the nation idea. And I say it's the Jewish basis because international law was created by Jews and it's carried on by Jews. And almost every major international lawyer is Jewish. The important ones certainly are. So they're the ones who have who are behind all this. Yeah. It's a real racket, this international law thing. One could not, Bardesh says, one could not wish for more precise assertions. And this political philosophy has at least the merit of being clear. It sets up conscientious objection as a duty. It imposes the refusal to obey, you're forced to refuse to obey. Its hatred of military states is such that it destroys the entire state. What was the honor and the drama of the soldier are denied by it in one single sentence. The grandeur of the discipline is crossed out with the stroke of a pen. The honor of the men, which is the honor of a faithful servant, honor such as has been written in our consciences since the first oath sworn to a sovereign, this honor exists no more. It is not inscribed by the civic instruction manual. Only your expert judges did not see that by destroying the monarchical form of fidelity, they destroyed all the fatherlands. For there is no regime which does not rely on the contract of service. There is no sovereignty other than the monarchical, and the republics themselves have invented the expression, a sovereign people. From now on, this conscience, which is clear about its duty, is no more. The order of the sovereign is deposed from its absolute power. The indisputable, the certain, is abolished everywhere. The edict placed on the wall no longer has any authority. Obedience to the magistrate is a matter of circumstance. It is no more permitted to anyone to say, the law is the law, the king is the king. All that was clear. All that enabled us to die tranquil in all that enabled us to die tranquil is undercut by these absurd sentences. The state no more has a form. The city no more has walls. A new sovereign, without a capital and without a face, reigns in their place from now on. Its tabernacle is a radio. It is there that one hears each evening the voice to which we owe obedience, that of the superstate, which has primacy over the fatherland. Because the sentence written by the judges in their judgment is clear, it leaves no place for ambiguity. If the conscience of humanity has condemned a nation, the citizens of that nation are released from their bond of obedience. And not only are they released from it, but they must act against their own country. Because, quote, the international obligations which are imposed on individuals have precedence over their duty of obedience toward the state of which they are citizens. Thus, at this point of our analysis, one discovers that everything holds and fits together well. We are no more the soldiers of a fatherland. We are the soldiers of the moral law. And this doesn't even sound strange to us today. There's a point, I'm going to be going over somewhat from my two-hour limit, so those of you who are listening right now, the show will end at, about 6-7 minutes, and you won't hear any music, but you'll get the rest of it afterwards. But this is so important here. That what comes to me is that saying that we follow the moral law over and above any fatherland, it doesn't even, is something we're so used to today. It would have been more strange back then. It would have been more new back then, even though it had been brought forward enough, but today, I think one of the problems we face is that we don't understand this anymore. We agree with this new order. More than we're against the new order, but then if you look at all the specifics about it, we agree with it. So he writes, we are no more the citizens of a nation. We are consciences in the service of humanity, following the results of the Nuremberg Tribunal, which I said earlier has been taken by Putin and Russia as being the final say about the truth, about truth, in that if you can't question the results and the findings of the Nuremberg Tribunal. Well, you can't do it in Germany either. All then makes sense, Bardesh writes. It is not a question of knowing whether Marshal Pétain is the legal chief of the government of France. France does not exist. Legality does not exist. It is a question of knowing whether General de Gaulle incarnates international morals more exactly than Marshall Catan, between the democracy incarnated by a committee, between the democracy incarnated by a committee improvised in London, in France, represented by a government which does not convene the general councils, there can be no hesitation. One must prefer the democracy, because morals are necessarily on the side of the democracy. Excuse me. While France, that does not represent anything with regard to morals. There we are. We are thus in the presence of the complete intellectual landscape of the brain of Mr. de Menthon. From now on, it is a democracy which is to the fatherland. I'm sorry, I'm looking around. From now on, it is a democracy which is the fatherland, and the fatherland is nothing more, is nothing anymore if it is not democratic. To prefer the fatherland to democracy, that is treason. When democracy is threatened, patriotism is always on the side of democracy. If the fatherland is in the opposite camp, that makes no difference in that case. Resistance is the supreme law. Treason is obligatory, and fidelity is treason. It is the sniper who is the true soldier. Now, mentioning Mr. de Menthon, he was the French, the lead prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Tribunal for the French. And he gave in his opening speech defining a crime against humanity as a crime against human laws motivated by an ideology that is a crime against the spirit, returning humanity to barbarism. So there you have the human law and the word humanity again in that definition. So Bardèche, moving forward again in the book, he writes, we had concluded previously that it was nationalisms, and with them the modes of expression or of defense of nationalisms, which were attacked by the spirit of Nuremberg. The new law led to a dispossession. We see now that it is not only nationalisms which are put under indictment, but the fatherlands themselves. So he's using the word fatherland a lot, and for me it evokes something wonderful that nothing else does evoke in all this writing of his. So it's saying it's not just nationalism, but it's the fatherlands themselves which are under indictment. The spiritual is confiscated for the benefit of a higher international authority. It is that which says what is just. It is that which is the conscience of the world. The fatherlands are deposed. They are deposed for the benefit of a spiritual empire of the world which has precedence, as they say, over all the fatherlands. There is from now on, there is officially, since the judgment of Nuremberg, a religion of humanity, and there is also a Catholicism of humanity. We owe submission to the very Holy Church of humanity. It is hardly necessary to underline here how useful this beautiful preliminary work can ultimately be for the universal reign of Marxism, whose Gorgon face one pretends to perceive today. For in the end, what else does Marxism maintain but with another meaning for the words? For Marxists, indeed, the national law in each country is trumped by the duty which is binding on individuals to take part in the liberating struggle of the proletariat. For them, indeed, there is always, above their obligations as citizens, a universal conscience, which is nothing other than class consciousness. This Marxist conscience upbraids in the same terms and is likewise vague. With it too, it is a matter of being in line. The theorists of the universal conscience did not see very well that this weapon by which they give so much care is similar to that javelin of the Australians, which can always return to strike the thrower. All that they do can be turned against them. All that they affirm can serve their enemy. And we should not be astonished today if the Communist Party informs us that the French people will not accept the war against Russia. That is an application of the principle of Nuremberg. For in the end, Nuremberg destroys fatherlands. Who destroys them better than communism? Nuremberg founds an international authority. Is not Moscow one? That is an international authority. Nuremberg creates a church. There exists another, which is the Third International. Nuremberg decrees the reign of the universal conscience. It will be enough for Bolshevism to disguise itself with the skin so as to appear as good as they. Another result obtained is that of the real deposition of the human person, which is inseparable from the deposition of the fatherlands. Now, it's a new theme of the human person coming up here. This second result is initially more surprising than the first, because the Nuremberg court took as its theme the defense of the human person. But this, unfortunately, is nonetheless certain. It's certain that they did this, which is unfortunate, he thinks. This man of the earth and the cities, this man who has been man as long as there have been peoples and cities, it is precisely he that Nuremberg condemns and repudiates. For the new law says to him, you will be a citizen of the world. You will, you yourself will also be packaged and dehydrated. A reference to modern food, industrial food products. You will not listen anymore to the rustle of your trees and the voice of your bells, but you will listen to hear the voice of the universal conscience. Shake the dirt from your shoes, peasant. This land is nothing anymore. She soils, she obstructs, she prevents one from making pretty packagings. Modern times have come. Listen to the voice of modern times. The Polish laborer who changes jobs 12 times a year is the same man as you. The Jewish rag hawker who has just arrived from Horocha or Hitomir is the same man as you. They have the same rights as you on your land and on your city. Respect the Negro, O peasant. They have the same rights as you, and you will set places for them at your table, and they will enter into the council, where they will teach you what the universal conscience says, which you do not yet hear as well as you should. And their sons will be respected men, and they will be established as judges over your sons. They will govern your city, and they will buy your field, for the universal conscience gives them expressly all these rights. As for you, peasant, if you meet with your friends and long for the time when you saw only local boys at the city fair, know that you are opposing the universal conscience and that the law does not protect you against that. For such, in truth, is the condition of man after the demotion of fatherlands. One perforce supports regimes that make cities wide open to strangers. One demands that these foreigners receive the same rights as the inhabitants of the country. And one condemns solemnly every attempt at discrimination. Then one recognizes as legitimate only one manner of deliberation, that which is purely numerical. Under this system, what city will not be, in a given time, overcome by a peaceful conquest, swamped by any occupying army without uniforms, and offered finally to the reign of foreigners? Well, this is exactly what we're experiencing the final days of, really, now, of this overcoming of people with greater numbers who are building up their numbers beyond what our numbers are. All numerical. That's the majority then. The majority rules. I have a couple of quotes here from Frerichs, but I'm going to let those go by since I don't have time for them. I want to continue with Bardesh. He writes, and above will reign the fact that the human person, a capital H, capital P, is the one for whom this war was waged, the one who invented this law. For at last, no matter what one says, there is a human person. And this is not the Germans of the Volga, nor the people in the Baltics, nor is it the Chinese or the Malagasy. It is not the Anamasi, or the Czechs. And of course, it is not the proletariat, the human person. We know very well what this is. This term has all its signification. If it refers to a stateless individual who was born in a Krakow suburb, who suffered under Hitler, was interned, is not dead, and has nonetheless been revived in the form of a French, Belgian, or Luxembourg patriot on whom we are invited to bestow all our respect and adoration. The human person, in addition, is usually provided with an international passport, an authorization to export, a tax exemption, and the right to requisition apartments. We might add that the human person, so defined, is most especially the agent of the universal conscience. He is, so to speak, its electoral vase. For this role, he possesses organs of an exquisite sensitivity, which other men lack. Thus, in a country where he has just arrived as a refugee, in a country where he has just arrived, meaning that he's a refugee, which there were plenty during that time after the war, he designates with certainty the true patriots and detects at a great distance the organisms which stubbornly resist the vibrations of a universal conscience. This refers to what he was saying above about about the Jews going into being allowed into other people's lands, and then pretty soon they're saying what's wrong there and what needs to be done, and even condemning the native peoples, the indigenous people there, for not behaving properly toward them. So he goes on, accordingly, these precious gifts of theirs that they have to detect people who are resisting the universal conscience are used, as is appropriate, before public opinion. All their vibratile reactions are carefully recorded, and the total of these vibrations constitutes what one calls at a given moment the indignation or the approval of the universal conscience. They are what formulate finally the dogma which we already mentioned and which has as its title Defense of the Human Person. Well, that's the end of what I took from this book. I leave it to you to decide what is meant by the human person. But one choice would be the Jew, but it might also be the refugee, the survivor, which also fits in with the Jew. There's some fantastic ideas in there, and more fantastic because it was written in 1948 and it has come to pass. You know, we talk about 1984 and written in 1949 and what he saw, but we don't have a world just like that today. It might have been, it never was, not even in the Soviet Union was it like what's in 1984, at all, really. Something along those lines, but not really like that. But in this case, what Bardesh wrote, it is exactly this way. And another example we have of something written that turned out very to be very prophetic and correct is the elders of the Zion, the elders of The Elders of Zion. How did that thing start out? Oh, well. But this one is pretty amazing. And I would say that what is the moral of this story? You know, as I was trying to answer it a little bit. And it is that, as I, in my opinion, because I've been saying this for a long time, to turn this around, to turn around what we've got, we have to go back to Nuremberg. We can't refuse to pay attention to it. We can't deny it. We can't say we don't need to deal with it. We have to deal with it. We have to go back because that's where it started. And that's where the consciousness of humanity and the destruction of the fatherlands and the rise of the human person over ethnic members of the national family was established. At least he's made a very good case for that. The indigenous population of every nation was dispossessed. We have to get back to the beginning, cleanse the slate by revealing and exposing everything, then rebuild, in my opinion, on the model of Germany's National Socialism. Germany's National Socialist State. Well, you don't have to do it that way, but that's one way to do it because it's all there. It's all there. It's all the literature is all there, and it tells us everything. But if you don't like that, and then do it differently. But the discussion, I think this is a contribution to the discussion of do we want individual white nations still, or do we want to have some kind of united, overarching, single white nation? And I won't even go into my ideas about that right now because I've already indicated that. I have a letter here, but I don't have time to read it. I'm not going to take the time to read it from a listener that what it indicates, I might read it on Monday, but what it indicates is that here's someone who listened to that interview I did on at Red Ice Radio with Lana and Lotkoff. I think that's it, Lotkoff. He says he's learning about Holocaust revisionism, and it's difficult because it's all, you know, he was brought up, you know, with what he learned in the schools and so on, but he's trying to learn about it as much as he can. But his problem is with National Socialism, and I talked about that on the interview, and he says he has a problem with thinking that could possibly be a good form of government. And because it's socialism and it can lead to tyranny and so on, and he thinks everybody is responsible for their own happiness and their own selves, and the government, the state, he says, the state should not be involved in people's lives and so on. So I wrote to him and described National Socialism in my way of thinking. And then he admitted, and I said he sounded like a libertarian, he admitted that he has some type of libertarian, but only to an extent. And just all the things that he said revealed what I started out saying in this program, that we think we want something for our race, but we're so into this New World Order type way of living what's been offered to us in the form of thinking that we're free and that we should be able to do what we want and we shouldn't be tied down to anything, that most people and plenty of young people can't let that go and don't want to even let it go. They like it. They're tied into it. And a lot of people, as I told him, who say, oh, yeah, I'm a National Socialist. They really don't even know what they're saying. Is if they had to live accordingly, they wouldn't want to do it because they haven't been, prepared properly for it. So we're in a bad way as far as doing anything about our situation. And I've got this thing by Francis. I'm going to take the time to tell you this little story about Prime Minister Hollande of France. He's not the Prime Minister, he's the President. François Hollande, French President, just yesterday in Newport, Wales, at the NATO conference thing, his ex-wife or his ex-partner, and who was also his first lady when he started, when he was first elected president in France, she's written a book, and she's accused him of despising the poor, or, you know, not really liking the poor, saying all kinds of things against the poor. And he's a big-time socialist, you see. And he's very hurt by all this, and he's not very popular in the polls right now either. So he's come out to defend himself. And it says, an indignant Hollande insisted Friday on his commitment to the weakest, the most humble, the poorest. And he called it his raison for being is the poor. And he said, I will never accept that the commitment of a lifetime, what his life has been all about will be put into question. I mean, here's one of our leaders. Of course, we know he's no good, but he actually says that he's committed to the weakest, most humble, and the poorest among us. It's not even true. But if it were true, that doesn't make it good. You know, it's not good. It's kind of sick, really. And this is his whole reason for being, is to be committed, is to help these people. His whole reason for living. And this is the kind of thing that conscience of humanity takes people to. And this is so applauded, in a sense, you know. Well, he was elected based on this type of rhetoric. He was elected president of France. So this is how far down, how far we've come, and what a long way it is to get back into sensible thinking. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening to this long program today. And I will no doubt continue on this type of theme on Monday. But I think this book by Bardesh, it makes a real excellent contribution to the debate that we are having, and that it should be better known. And as I told you, if you want to read it or begin reading it or look through it, you can, if you just Google it, you'll find the PDF by that ARG committee that's been up for a long time that I got it from. But I've also posted it at .org. Probably don't even know that thing. And you'll always find it there. So once again, it's been a pleasure to be with you again today. And this is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. The date is September 6, 2014, signing off.